Hi folks, Barry here. Just a couple of quick things before you listen to this week's episode of Worstwood Forward, all about the world's worst admiral. First things first, this is a Patreon-supported episode. Thank you to our Patreon donor, Tim Wren, who has suggested this week's episode. If you want to be like Tim, be more Tim, visit patreon.com/worstwoodforward, where you too can donate to us. And if you donate $5 or more a month, then you get to suggest an episode just like Tim did. So hopefully, Tim, you will enjoy what we have created. Thank you to our newest Patreon donor, Jacob Faber, who's just become our highest donating Patreon donor ever. Thank you so much, Jacob, for your incredibly generous donation. We will be in touch with you about all of the rewards that you're entitled to. We really greatly appreciate people digging into their pockets and helping us continue making the show, particularly with the year that's in it. And so thank you very much for being an absolute hero. One other thing to say, the episode you're about to listen to, we recorded with Eric, who is based in Australia, and the internet was not playing ball with us throughout the recording. So we had some sound quality issues throughout, which we've done our best, obviously, to mitigate in the edit. But the apologies, of course, if there are some occasional bits of staticky sound and interference throughout. That's just what we have to deal with when we're doing recordings online, as we have been doing for most of the last 7 or 8 months. Other than that, thanks as ever to everyone who listens to and supports the show. We hope you're enjoying the content we've been making. Hope you're about to enjoy this one. All aboard for the world's worst admiral. Hello and welcome to Worstwood Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. What shall we do with the drunken sailor? What shall we do with the drunken sailor? What shall we do with the drunken sailor? No, genuinely I'm asking, because he's vomiting in my bunk and he's started a fight with the bosun. Put him in the longboat till he's sober, you say? And shave his belly with a rusty razor? Then tie him to the mast until you flog him? Jesus, I thought you might just suggest Alka-Seltzer and a big glass of water. You're sick and deranged. And I'll pronounce it however I like, thanks. And it's spelt Erli, so there. And alongside me is the Admiral Insurance to my Commodore 64, Ben Vandeveld.
Yo, ho, ho.
You're a pretty able seaman, aren't you? Sorry, I'm just going to get that one out of the way first and foremost.
Well done. I am willing to be your cabin boy anytime, Barry. 15 all, much abandoned for too much punning. The thing is, I'm the sort of person who's not innately practical. I haven't got much initiative, but if you put me on board something like a boat and give me a job within my capabilities, I'll bloody well do that job.
But I feel like maybe lockdown over the world has been like a poor imitation, but an imitation nonetheless of life at sea for a long period of time. We've all been stuck indoors, not being able to do very much, trying to sort of stick by our routines and building periscopes into our upstairs neighbours' flats.
Yeah, I have been inches away from recording a teary Ellen MacArthur video on so many days. I think her and Sir Ranulph Fiennes should play the world's largest game of hide and seek.
Tag, she sails around the world, and when he gets her, he climbs a mountain.
Well, talking of tag, our guest this week is someone who has the capabilities to be an unbeatable tag and hide and seek champion. Mariana Trench, anyone? He is a comedian, a writer and performer, and most importantly, a former submariner in Her Majesty's Navy. Over the past decade, he has become a regular fixture at arts festivals all over the world, particularly in Edinburgh and Adelaide, where he has performed his own Tales of the Sea, a submariner's yarn, where he has done his very best not to break the Official Secrets Act while spinning a compendium of extraordinary naval yarns, including encounters with sharks and near-death experiences during submarine escape training. He now resides in Australia, we presume, if he's staying on theme for this show, in a submarine stranded somewhere near Ayers Rock. It is a delight, ladies and gentlemen, to welcome on board the show, Eric.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us with I think probably our largest ever time difference we've had on the show.
I'm presently just north of Mars.
Yeah. Is it wet as well? Now we found the moon as well.
I've got the porthole shut at the moment. How
have you coped with the lockdown conditions and everything? I presume with hardy experience of life at sea.
It's been absolutely brilliant. I must admit, I've monitored my friends on Facebook, never responding to anyone, obviously. I've got very distinct groups of friends. I've got my old Navy buddies, and I've got all my sort of arty buddies. And as soon as the lockdown hit, all my arty buddies said, oh, this is the worst thing in the world. It's terrible. I can't see anyone. I can't do anything. It's awful. Help. And all my submarine buddies went, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to get a big case of beer in. I'm going to get a big stack of steaks. And they just said how they were going to get through it. And to be honest, for them and people like them, this is really sort of pretty standard.
I like to imagine you and all your Navy friends looking at the arty types and just being like, ugh, fucking amateurs. It's not that difficult.
I have to say, there is something sinister, though, about someone who says they monitor their friends.
I did realise, as I said it, that those words would probably come back to haunt me. There was a quote that I read just recently. Our forefathers were asked to go and fight a war. What we've been asked to do is sit on the sofa and watch the TV. Which I think puts it in perspective.
To be fair, though, there was nothing on in the 40s. They didn't have the Crown.
I'm going to just tell you a very quick story, which you can edit out later.
Yeah, feel free.
Who went across to the war cemeteries across the Channel, and they all went together. They all had relatives who'd been killed during the Great War. One by one, they found the graves, and one guy they just couldn't find his grandfather's grave, and they searched everywhere for it, and they just couldn't find it, and they were just on the point of leaving, and one of the guys said, "I found it." And they looked up and he says, "Over here." Apparently he was German.
Clearly you're very good at coping with difficult situations. What are you not so good at? What would you say you're worst at in the world?
Oh, there's a million things I'm not so good at. I think if I've got to narrow it down to one, probably sneezing. I've got the loudest sneeze in the world. That's not official. The Guinness Book of Records haven't ratified that. But to give you an idea of how loud my sneeze is, I was in a post office pre-lockdown, and I sneezed and set off their alarm.
Oh, wow.
Surely that's got to be incredibly dangerous on board a submarine.
Yeah.
Well, it's no pollen. You're fairly okay. But I mean, sort of every relationship I've ever had, everyone's always said, "Oh, why do you have to sneeze so loud?" And I've always believed it's an involuntary thing. You can't control it. Until I saw QI just recently, it's an affectation. If you've never heard anyone sneeze, then when you sneeze, you won't make a noise.
I have to say that I have quite a loud sneeze, and I can hear my dad's sneeze in it. It sounds very like how my dad sneezes, so I can kind of get that I'm imitating him, clearly.
You've got an hereditary sneeze.
Yes. I've just looked it up, by the way. The world record for the loudest sneeze is held by a man in China called Yi Yang, who sneezes at 176 decibels, which is louder than a jet engine or a gunshot.
I'd like to see him sneeze on an office chair and propel himself back into the wall.
Yeah, longest distance for a sneeze.
Yeah.
Oh, that is absolutely a taskmaster round, isn't it?
How loud do you sneeze? About 17 feet.
Yeah.
This week on the show, we are heading to sea in Eric's company to talk about the world's worst admiral. And Ben, it's you first, so pipe us aboard, please.
I absolutely will. First of all, a little bit of etymology. I looked up where the word admiral came from, and it is from the Anglo-French amiral, which means commander, and that's related to medieval Latin admiralis, admiralis. As well as having Latin roots, it also has Arabic roots as well, because in Arabic, amir or amir al means commander of. And it's just occurred to me, that means the boxer Amir Khan, his name literally translated means Commander King.
Yeah.
Which, considering his record of getting knocked out by any one like half decent in the ring. He hasn't really lived up to the nominative determinism there. Before we start looking at terrible people, I'm going to want to tell you about someone who should probably be known more historically. She is going to be terrible for certain reasons, but the very fact that she is a she is interesting. Let me tell you about Isabel Barreto de Castro. So she was a Spanish sailor and traveler in the mid-16th century, and she was the first known woman to hold the office of admiral in European history. She was married to a chap called Alvaro de Mendaña, who was a Spanish navigator, and he was sailing around the world doing, let's be honest, some pretty horrible things in the name of colonialism and the Spanish Empire. He passed away. The command fell to her brother. He passed away. And so she took control of the boat along with the main pilot, Pedro Fernandez de Quiroz. And she sailed from the South America all the way to Manila. 4,000 miles?
Across the Pacific, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, this is going to sound like a poor attrition rate. The ship began with 378 men and women aboard. And by the end, there were 100 people aboard. But one in three surviving a cross-Pacific journey in the 16th century is pretty solid odds. Now, it turns out the way she managed to keep them in line was the way all sort of early modern admirals did, and having a pretty uncompromising attitude to any signs of mutiny or conspiring against her, and she made healthy use of corporal punishment.
Could the 1-in-3 ratio have been higher if she hadn't kept executing people for looking at her funny?
She was just trying to make room.
Yeah.
It's sort of a truism you say whenever there is a remarkable woman in any time in history before about the 1850s, but to be doing that at a time when women were not thought to be capable of such things is genuinely remarkable, even if she was doing it in the name of really quite disgusting colonialism and wiping out empires in South America. So she's worth chatting about. Eric, have you heard the phrase tapping the admiral?
I don't think so.
So there's a similar phrase, which is sucking the monkey. And
no, they're not similar.
They're not similar, and that is why HMS Navy has got a lifetime ban from London Zoo. In the 18th and 19th century, sailors were allotted their own share of, I imagine, mostly rum, maybe occasionally beer, but they would hammer through that pretty quickly. And so in order to get more, they would bore small holes in the alcohol barrels and drink the contents through their straws, and that practice was known as sucking the monkey. It became known as tapping the admiral for this goddamn brilliant reason.
Yeah, Nelson.
Correct, yeah. Nelson died in 1805 during the Battle of Trafalgar, and rather than being buried at sea, he was put in a cask of rum, and the body was preserved in that. However, the sailors were like, we need a bloody drink after that battle we've just been through. And so legend has it, and it may be apocryphal, that on the way home, so many sailors sucked the rum that was preserving Nelson in his cask, that by the time it got home, the cask was empty, save for a fairly prune-like admiral. And thus, tapping the admiral was born.
Hmm. Yeah. There is a possibility that it had just been soaked up into the body in preserving it. Apparently by the time it reached Greenwich, his face looked so grim that they had to cover it when he was lying in state.
Sailors are porous.
Yes.
I sort of think, I imagine like Nelson is Her Majesty's Navy equivalent of the tequila worm, and that if they'd have consumed his body, they'd have seen the most incredible psychedelic colours.
Yeah, they've got to lick some salt, chuck back the rum, bite into a lime, and then eat Admiral Nelson.
The origin of the phrase, limeys.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, many people think something to do with scurvy. Nothing to do with that sort. Yeah.
Here is a gentleman who sounds like my absolute nightmare of both an admiral and a housemate. And he's got a name that is, it will immediately make your buttocks clench. Admiral Algernon Charles Fieschi Henage.
Mm-hmm.
He was a 19th century admiral, and he was all about strict discipline and, most importantly, cleanliness being next to godliness, and that is the way that you keep everything shipshape. And so when he toured the ship to make sure that everything was as it should be, stood behind him, or following behind him, was a coxswain with a mound of fresh white gloves that would be carried upon a silver platter. And when he got to every new place, he would put on a new pair of gloves and do the white glove test to make sure that there was no dirt or grime there.
Sounds like being back in boarding school.
Yeah. We should talk about admirals who weren't very good. And I mean, very often when I criticise people on here, I'm doing it from a position of a very low skill level. So obviously, I've got an enormous amount of respect for anyone who can make a basic catamaran go, never mind a battleship. But Admiral George Tryon, not a great name for an admiral. He is famous for killing a lot of people by mistake. In 1893, the Royal Navy was doing some maneuvers in the Mediterranean, just off the North African coast, and he ordered both ships to turn toward each other in succession rather than reverse. And I think he got a response from the captains of those ships of, "Are you sure?" He was like, yeah, no, absolutely do that. Because he believed they were the necessary 1 nautical mile or 10 cables apart. They were actually 6 cables apart, and they crashed into each other, drowning most of the people aboard, including Admiral Tryon. And it is one of the worst naval accidents in British history.
But it's notoriously easy to turn large battleships quickly.
Yeah.
No, he did it deliberately. What he was actually trying to do, he was Admiral Tryon was a brilliant man, and he was a maths genius. He would not have made that mistake. In order for those two columns to turn, they needed 8 cables to separate them, and mm-hmm. he ordered 6 cables, which meant they would collide. And the reason he did it is because the Navy had become so steeped in tradition and discipline that there was no innovative thought. There was no questioning of authority. People just did what they were told regardless, and they didn't do anything unless they were told. It was a don't speak until you're spoken to, don't do anything unless you're ordered. It was a recipe for disaster. And what he was trying to do, he was trying to bring the Navy out of that. And what he did, he ordered his subordinate, or Vice Admiral Markham, to turn inwards at 6 cables, knowing that the ships would collide, hoping that Markham would say no and use his initiative. He didn't. He went ahead and did it. Tryon made a massive, massive mistake. Tryon was this larger-than-life character.
Mm-hmm.
He used to beat people down with the weight of his argument. He was a totally brilliant man, and no one dared question him. He'd achieved everything. By trying to shift the Navy into a new epoch, he was trying to drag a stone through the mud, and it just simply didn't work.
I like the idea that as the ships were going down, he was just stood on the bridge going, "Well, I like to think I've made my point."
It was a late imperialism version of the Kobayashi Maru from Star Trek.
Yes.
He'd had a dinner time session, come out the pub legless and said, "Well, I'll tell you what, let's turn the ships around."
Yeah.
Barry, you make a really good point, because he did go down with his ship.
And
if what he really wanted to do was bring the Navy out of this, their old ways, why not start with not going down with your ship?
Yeah.
It was frowned upon if you didn't. But he could have said, "Well, I'll tell you what, that's nonsense. Because if you go down with your ship, you're depriving the Navy of a valuable resource." He was court-martialed posthumously, because you always have a court-martial whenever there's a sinking. What they should have done was say, "Well, okay, well, you've gone down with your ship. We're going to do you for desertion. You've legged it from the Navy." And during wartime, I think any captain who goes down with his ship should be tried for treason, because it is an act which is aiding and abetting the enemy.
That's a good point, to be fair. And I mean, if he doesn't go down with the ship, at least he's able to come back and go, "Well, you see, the point of the whole thing was," and you can explain his thinking.
Also, like saying, like, a captain should always go down with his ship. I mean, that's easy for a submariner to say.
Yeah,
that's your job, mate. Have we heard of Admiral Richmond K. Turner?
The American.
Yeah, so he was working in the Pacific, during World War II. He was working underneath the commander of the US Pacific Fleet, Admiral Husband E. Kimmel, who should also get a shout out here, along with Admiral Harold Rainsford Stark. The three of them are a triumvirate of complacency. But particularly with Turner, as described by another admiral as being brilliant, caustic, arrogant and tactless. Just the man for the job. To be fair to him, he was trying to deal with the still fairly new technology of radar at the time. But his responsibility was to let Admiral Kimmel know if there were any threats from the Pacific, specifically the Japanese, because we all know where this is going to end up. He essentially failed to recognize the threat of the Japanese forces. In fact, there is some debate that one of the things that he thought was the Japanese forces was actually just a landmass that he'd failed to identify properly on the nascent technology.
Yeah, a whole Japanese squadron of cruisers came past them and they didn't think, oh, the land's moving.
Yeah, gosh, that ice flow seems to be on quite a holiday. And this is, I mean, this is the sort of thing where... How can I put it? I'm delighted that our side won World War II, but when he describes that the reason why he said that this happened, he said, well, I did have a fairly lethargic state of mind because we had technical and mental superiority over the enemy. Like, there's many things that I would like from my military, but one of them is not complacency. I don't want it from my football team, so I do not want it from my military.
He had a guy under his command called Captain Bode, the skipper of USS Chicago. He'd been the captain of Chicago for a while. He was ashore when Sydney Harbour was raided by Japanese midget submarines. Small submarines invaded Sydney Harbour, and the captain of USS Chicago was ashore having dinner with the admiral, and he got legless. When he was called back on board, because these submarines were running rampant in the harbour, he was so drunk he didn't believe it, and he just remonstrated with his crew. He said, you're firing at nothing, you're a bunch of idiots. He wouldn't let them get underway. He was remonstrating with the first lieutenant, and he said to him, you wouldn't know a submarine if you saw one. And just as he said that, one surfaced in front of them, and the first lieutenant said, they look like that, sir.
One last thing before my suggestion. This is something I think both you and me, Barry, found, and it's a delight. I looked up various landlocked nations and states that have their own navy. My favourite one being the American state of Nebraska. And Nebraska, known very much for its cornfields rather than its salt water, but you can become an honorary admiral of Nebraska's non-existent Navy.
Just to be clear, Nebraska is the only triple landlocked state in America. Yep, not only is it landlocked, but the states around it are landlocked, and those states are landlocked.
Wow, I love that, the triple irony of that. And basically it's sort of the equivalent of a Nebraska knighthood, I think, really. The Great Navy of the state of Nebraska was created in 1931. The urging of his friends, he appointed some prominent Nebraskans as Nebraskan admirals, and it's also an opportunity as a Nebraskan admiral to sort of use it to do charitable work. But I'm going to read you a list of some notable admirals, and I just want you to imagine, like, a fleet led by this eclectic crew of human beings. Classic comedian Jack Benny, former president George W. Bush, entertainment superstar Johnny Carson, Christmas hero Bing Crosby, our own monarch Queen Elizabeth II, basketball superstar Julius Dr. J. Irving, late night TV host Craig Ferguson, the king of the nerds Bill Gates, mountain climber Sir Edmund Hillary, you shouldn't be an admiral, mate, get stay in your lane, civil rights leader Martin Luther King III, cameo genius and comedy genius Bill Murray, and last of all, my favourite one is seven-time Olympic gold medal winner Mark Spitz. Like a gold medal winning swimmer being an admiral feels wrong.
Yeah.
Well, if the ship does go down, he will survive.
Yeah, that is true.
Did you see the award certificate, what it says in it? Well, if you get to join the Nebraska Admirals Association, it says, "And I, the governor of Nebraska, do strictly charge and require all officers, seamen, tadpoles, and goldfish under your command to be obedient to your orders as admiral." It's very tongue-in-cheek. Yeah. And sort of awards people who promote the good life in Nebraska. They have a website which I had a little look on. On the website it says, for example, "It's believed that several hundred thousand admirals have been appointed. Many Nebraskans and visitors to our state have not heard of our Navy. They have not heard of the waves of prairie schooners that at one time plied our plains, under which our real wealth, Nebraska's underground sea, lies." And they have a list. They have a list of, purposes on the website as well, like promoting Nebraska products and trying to develop and maintain ports throughout the state. Have U.S. naval ships named after Nebraska and Nebraskans. But my favorite one on it is to enjoy fun activities such as walking the plank. And on the website, it has a picture of a couple of people who are clearly being inducted, holding what is just like a small 2x4 with the words "the plank" on it, with a couple of bits of rope on either end of it, like they're walking a dog. Yeah.
But my suggestion for the world's worst admiral comes from the 12th century, and it comes from England, and his name is William Atheling, also known as Adelin. He was the only legitimate son of Henry I of England and Queen Matilda of Scotland, and thus the heir to the throne of England. And in 1120, he was in charge of a vessel called the White Ship. And the night before he was about to sail it across the channel, he basically got hammered with all of his crew. And the next day, he went into the channel in the White Ship. It hit a rock and it sank near Barfleur off the coast of Normandy. Now, as far as you guys might be concerned, that's a fairly poor piece of seamanship. Not hugely remarkable. However, since he was the only son of Henry I and Matilda, he created an enormous problem of the succession, which led to a period of history that I'd never heard of before called the Anarchy. And the Anarchy was an 18-year civil war that ravaged England and Scotland, caused the rule of law to absolutely fall to pieces, and turned England into a failed state for 18 years. So it's all very well of our friend Richmond K. Turner forgetting about the Japanese, but, you know, on the bright side, that brought the Americans into the war and helped us win. Or, you know, your man George Tryon trying to play an enormous game of chicken with British naval tradition. It's very, very sad, and many people died, but it was an experiment that went wrong. But this drunken, entitled, privileged royal yahoo just going like drunk sailing in appalling contravention of his responsibilities, leading to the downfall of his father's kingdom for 18 years is dreadful. And a commentator at the time, Henry of Huntington, spoke of the disaster that William, instead of wearing embroidered robes, floated naked in the waves, and instead of ascending to a lofty throne, found his grave at the bottom of the sea. Other chroniclers at the time described the period of the Anarchy as being a time at which Christ and his saints were asleep in England and Normandy.
That's one massive hangover.
Yeah.
A lot of admirals, they get a very bad reputation for making one mistake and losing one battle. My nomination is someone who's done more than that. Because one mistake is, you know, anyone can make one mistake. Nelson made a terrible mistake at Tenerife, where he not only lost the battle, but lost an arm as well. So, I mean, that is really, really a bad day. But there was an upside to it, because it cured Nelson of his overconfidence up to that point. And from then on, he was spectacularly successful up until the sailors drank his rum.
Yeah.
So my choice is actually probably... it may be controversial, because many consider the admiral I'm going to pick as a great success. But to me, he's a flawed hero. My admiral is Admiral Earl David Beatty, whose famous quote was during the Battle of Jutland, "There seems to be something wrong with our bloody ships today."
Workmen and tools.
Yeah, exactly. He blamed everyone but himself.
Yeah.
He had quite a lot in common with Nelson. They both made Admiral, age 35. Nelson, because he was brilliant. BT, because of the tenure rules. They didn't want to lose him, so they had to promote him. They both had affairs. They both got injuries to their arms in battle. Bizarrely, for naval folk, both while ashore. And a little bit of trivia. George Tyrone also was injured while fighting ashore in the Crimea.
So clearly they should stick to what they're, well, I was about to say good at, but maybe less bad at.
Yeah, so Nelson learns from his mistakes, whereas Beatty doesn't, because all of his failures are spun into victories. He was very brave. He fought in the Sudan, in the Boxer Rebellion, and he was promoted because of his bravery. That was his perceived strength. His weaknesses, though, was he was meddling, his communication was terrible, he was impetuous, and he was overconfident. He was an ardent self-publicist. He married an heiress who was a social climber. To further the ambitions of both himself and his wife, he chose for his signalling officer a guy called Ralph Seymour. Now, he chose Ralph Seymour because of his aristocratic connections. His sister was friendly with Churchill's wife. So he was a very good man to have in your corner. The problem was he wasn't qualified as a signals officer, which is where Beatty's communications problems all stemmed from. In December 1914, Beatty is tasked to locate and destroy the enemy's battle cruisers as they're coming back from a raid on Scarborough. He has the aptly named Commodore Goodenough leading his light cruisers. Just before midday, Goodenough reports that he's found enemy cruisers and destroyers and he's attacking them. Beatty, who can't see what's happening, but he hears what the reports and thinks, well, Goodenough can deal with that. He's good enough. So he recalls the cruisers going to his help. Now, he only means to recall one of them, but the signal that is sent by Seymour is misinterpreted because it's ambiguous, and they think it applies to all of them. So all of the light cruisers who are now battling the Germans think, oh, well, we've been recalled. Because Tryon's attempt to get the Navy to think for themselves hasn't worked, they break off and they all return and the Germans escape. After the battle, Beatty blames everyone but himself. He wants Goodenough sacked. He takes no action against Seymour, although sending him on the signal officer's course would have been a really good step in the direction.
Yeah.
The following month, he has another crack. He's sent to Dogger Bank again to attack the German battlecruiser fleet. There are three German battlecruisers and a slower armoured cruiser. And Beatty has five battlecruisers, so it's five against four. The odds are against the Germans. They see Beatty, they turn and run. But their armoured cruiser slows them down. Beatty catches up, his ships are faster. They blow this armoured cruiser to bits. He then sends his slowest ship to finish off this armoured cruiser that's fallen out of line. So it's now four against three, and he sets off after them. One of the shells from one of the British ships hits a gun turret on the German flagship. It sets off an enormous fire. Flames leap 200 feet in the air. That spreads immediately to the adjacent turret. It kills both gun crews. There are explosions going off. The ship is on the point of sinking, but this heroic German shuts off the valve and floods the magazine and saves his ship. Beatty orders a 90-degree turn. He then asks his signal officer to order steer northeast by flag to bring them back in line with the Germans. It's his last useful contribution to the battle, because his ship is then damaged, falls out of line, and his second in command, Rear Admiral Archibald Moore, takes over. It's now three against three, and all Moore's got to do is just chase the Germans and beat them to submission.
Yeah.
Beatty can just let him get on with it, but that's not Beatty's style.
No.
with victory virtually assured, he's worried that with him out of it, Moore will get all the glory.
Oh.
So he thinks, well, what can I do? And he thinks, I know, with an eye to the history book and perhaps the press reports more pressingly, he tells his signal officer to make Nelson's famous signal, engage the enemy more closely, which is the signal that Nelson made after England expects and flies all the way through the battle. But it's 100 years since Nelson. This signal's been deleted. So he says, well, we've got attack the rear of the enemy. It's the closest we've got. So he substitutes that. So this is what BT decides. His flag signal is going to make no difference at all to the battle, except that it does. Seymour runs the order up on the same halyard as the order to steer northeast that he gave just before. So now the order reads, attack the rear of the enemy bearing northeast. Now, the only enemy that Archibald Moore can see in the northeast is this slow armoured cruiser, which has been battered to bits and is dead in the water. He breaks off the chase of the three German battle cruisers, one of which has very nearly sunk because it's been exploding all over the place because of its ammunition going off. And he returns and does as he's instructed and batters this hulk to bits.
So you got four to one against this one ship.
Yeah.
Wow.
Whilst for the second time, the Germans escape.
Wow.
Now, the only lessons that Beatty learns from that is, first of all, he sacks Moore for carrying out the order that he gave him.
Yeah.
Now, that brings us to Beatty's third and final battle, the Battle of Jutland.
Yeah.
Now, Battle of Jutland's the biggest naval battle in the world. To give it some context, the British Navy is 50% bigger than the German Navy. The German Navy know they can't win a toe-to-toe fight with the British. Their only hope is to isolate smaller elements of the British Navy and whittle it down until they can achieve parity. But the British have another advantage. They know the Germans' plans because they have the Germans' codes. The bad news is that the Admiralty don't grasp the importance of intelligence. They've got away with no intelligence in the Royal Navy for 300 years. Why should they start now? They're also paranoid about secrecy. They don't trust their civilian codebreakers because they're civilians. So they forbid the codebreakers from analysing the messages that they decode. They then have Navy analysts, but they're forbidden from seeing the messages that have been decoded. The only way that they can analyse the messages is to ask specific questions of the code breakers. If they want to know whether they should attack on a Wednesday, they have to ask a specific question. They're not allowed to give the context of the question, and the answer that the code breakers give, they're not allowed to expand on it.
They're playing 20 questions.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you can only give a yes or no answer. I've got 20 questions to ask.
Let's say you wanted to know whether you should put your washing out tomorrow.
Yeah.
You can't say to the codebreaker, I want to put my washing out. Will it be okay? You have to ask a specific question. And he's only allowed to answer that specific question. So you say to him, is it going to rain tomorrow? Looks at what he's got and he says, no. But what he's not allowed to do is he's not allowed to expand on the question. So he's not allowed to tell you, no, it's not going to rain, but there is going to be a hailstone storm followed by a hurricane.
Yeah.
and that's how the British were trying to run their intelligence.
Oh, my God.
They sort it out by the Second World War, but for the First World War, they're terrible. Unsurprisingly, not all the signals are interpreted correctly or indeed passed on. But one message does survive the Navy's effort to shoot itself in the foot. They learned on the 31st of May 1916 that the entire German fleet under Admiral Scheer, 100 ships, is going to go to sea, and it's going to have its battle cruisers under Rear Admiral Hipper as reconnaissance and bait. In order to trap small elements of the British Navy, they want to find Beatty. They want to then drag him back into the jaws of the entire German fleet. But the British read the code. So, in response, they have a plan. And it's identical. They're going to take the whole British fleet to sea, 150 ships, with BT as reconnaissance and bait in front of them. At 2 o'clock on the afternoon of the 31st of May, the battle cruisers find each other. BT ships are faster, they have bigger guns, longer range, and they outnumber the Germans 2-1.
Great.
What could possibly go wrong for BT? For reasons that make no sense to me, I don't know if that do it with anyone else, BT divides his forces. He leaves his most powerfully armed ships 5 miles behind the rest of his force. So he's got six battlecruisers with 4 of his best ships 5 miles behind. To make matters worse, the second he sees the enemy, he hares off after them, leaving these 4 ships behind. He does send a signal, but they're 5 miles away. Unsurprisingly, they can't see a bit of cloth flapping about on a flagpole 5 miles away, which is a distance from Tower Bridge to Hampstead Heath. So they're just left behind. The good news is he still outnumbers the Germans 6-5. Beatty then throws away his range advantage. He doesn't open fire until he thinks the Germans are in range. His shooting is terrible. His first shot goes over the Germans and lands 1 mile behind them. The Germans, meanwhile, have actually fired first. Within 3 salvos, they're hitting the British ships.
Oh, wow.
Again, the British aim is absolutely dreadful, with a notable exception of HMS Queen Mary, which is the most accurate ship that BT possesses. And the reason the German gunners are better trained is they've been practicing, whereas BT didn't bother. When asked about it, he said, oh, it'll be all right on the day.
Oh, no.
No.
That's Admiral Dennis Norden.
Yeah.
Yeah. Instead of practicing his gunnery, every afternoon, he prefers to play tennis. Beatty's own solution to this dreadful gunnery is simply increase the rate of fire. So his crew take shortcuts with their ammunition handling, dangerous shortcuts, which proved to be a fatal mistake. When the Germans hit the British gun turrets, which are full of stockpiled cordite, they just explode. And a fire goes down into the magazines, and 2 of BT's ships blow up.
Wow.
Which is when he utters the phrase, there seems to be something wrong with our bloody ships today.
Nice.
The really bad news, though, is the second ship to blow up is the Queen Mary, the only ship that he's got that can hit anything. Of his remaining ships, HMS Lion and HMS Princess Royal, fire at Hipper's flagship for an hour and a half, and they only hit it 3 times.
Oh, okay. Man.
I mean, that sounds bad, but you know, I've watched Newcastle in front of goal for the past couple of years, and that sounds like a hell of a hit rate.
The First Sea Lord's doctrine is hit first, hit hard, and keep on hitting, whereas Beatty's is miss first, miss by a mile, and then keep on missing.
Yeah, very much so.
But there is some good news for Beatty. Finally, the 4 ships that he left behind start catching up, and the bad news for Hipper is these aren't battlecruisers, these are battleships. So although they're slower, they have bigger guns and an even longer range. And the really, really bad news for Hipper is these are Evan Thomas's ships from the 5th Battle Squadron, and these guys can shoot. So they start hitting the German battlecruisers and causing damage. Commodore Goodenough, who's still with BT, goes racing ahead because he knows that the German plan is to lead the battlecruisers into a trap. So he goes racing ahead to look for the German battle fleet, and he finds it. He could just turn around and say, look, I've seen a heap of ships, must be the Germans, hightail it out of here. But he knows that his commanders need accurate information. They need to know what type of ships, how many, what's their course, what's their speed. So he carries on till he's only 13,000 yards from the entire German navy, gets this information, transmits it by wireless, which gives him away. The Germans then open fire on him. Luckily, he escapes. At this point, BT has been told by Goodenough he's been led into a trap. What he should do is turn and hightail it back to Jellicoe, who's waiting to spring his trap.
Yes.
So, what do you think BT does?
Oh, he engages the Germans like an idiot or something.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
to see for himself the German Navy. He can't just take Goodenough's word for it. So he goes and has a look. Evan Thomas, who's been absolutely busting the gut to catch up with the action, catches up with Beatty. Except Beatty is now heading in the opposite direction.
No.
Evan Thomas then sees the whole of the German Navy arrayed before him. All he has to do is turn and run away and he'll be okay. But Beatty isn't the sort of guy to just let Evan Thomas do that. His meddling is such that he flashes a signal to Evan Thomas as he tears past in the opposite direction, ordering him to turn 100 degrees in succession, not together. So Evan Thomas has now been ordered to carry on towards the Germans and then turn all of his ships through a single point in the ocean, one after another. Which means all the Germans need to do is target this one point.
Oh, no.
As the British ships obligingly sail into it. And by the time the last ship turns, the Germans are actually level with it. And many men die needlessly. Beatty is now leading the whole German fleet into Jellicoe's trap. All Beatty needs to do is give Jellicoe updates. Beatty leads Scheer north for an hour and a half. How many updates do you think he gives Admiral Jellicoe?
Not enough.
You're very nearly right. None at all.
Oh.
Absolutely none. In 90 minutes, he gives him no information at all. The first that Jellicoe knows the Germans coming is when he hears the gunfire from the battle raging between the battle cruisers. He's then shocked to see Beatty come hairing towards him from a completely different direction to what he's expecting. He finally gets the information that he needs from Beatty, but even then he has to ask him twice. He deploys his ships. Scheer stumbles into a trap of 150 British ships. Jellicoe's ships can shoot. They hit the Germans. And Scheer has no choice. He knows he can't stand and fight. He runs away. The only direction he can turn is west. That takes him towards Britain. He knows he can't run towards Britain.
Yeah.
Jellicoe's ships are now between Scheer and Germany. The only way that Scheer can get home is if he breaks through the British ships. The Germans, somehow or another, make it to nightfall when they are safe because the British haven't trained to fight at night. What Jellicoe does, he sets the best course that he can to try and keep the Germans from getting home. But he doesn't know where they're going, so he's got to take his best guess. At this stage, Beatty is let down by the Admiralty, who have intercepted Scheer's message, which says the route he's going to take home. But they don't tell Beatty. He's got to try and cover three courses at once. The hapless Seymour can't find the challenge and reply codes, which is a sort of naval halt, who goes there. So when they find a ship at night, they won't know whether it's friend or foe. So they flash a code to them. And then if they get the right code back, they go, oh, right, you're a friend. If they don't get the right code, they then open fire.
Are you about to tell us that the Germans snuck past?
I am. Because Seymour can't find the codes, he flashes to the nearest British ship. I can't find the codes. Could you flash me both the challenge and the reply? Which, of course, they do. In the darkness, just nearby, is a German ship. And it sees the challenge and the response. Now, the Germans have the British code for the night.
Amazing.
And whenever they're challenged by a British ship, they've got the option. They can either flash the reply or they can just blow it out of the water.
Yeah.
And by and large, they choose to blow it out of the water. Half of the British ships lost at the Battle of Jutland are sunk overnight. The morning, the Germans are all the way through the British line. They're home and they've escaped for the third time.
And are you gonna? And now, are you gonna tell me that Beattie got to retire, you know, comfortably, rather than being court-martialed?
Well, he did actually. Yeah.
Oh, of course he did.
Beattie's this great self-publicist, whereas Jellicoe is a very quiet man. He's very methodical. Famously, Churchill said of Jellicoe, he's the only man who could lose the war in an afternoon, because the Allies won the First World War wasn't because of the land battles, it was because of the blockade. And after 4 years of blockade, the Royal Navy had gallantly managed to starve as many women and children to death as they possibly could in Germany, and Germany collapsed.
Yeah.
Jellicoe were to lose the Battle of Jutland, he will lose the war. So he has to be cautious. Beattie, on the other hand, he throws himself at the Germans, loses ships hand over fist, and doesn't really give a toss, it seems. The reason that Beattie is the worst admiral is because although Jellicoe could lose the war in an afternoon, what Beattie does at the second Battle of Dogger Bank, by allowing the Germans to escape, and remember, their flagship's been hit, it nearly sinks, it's exploding all over the place. Because it escapes, it gets back to port, and the Germans investigate the causes of the fires and the explosions. And they find that there's a vulnerability to ships being hit in the gun turret. So what they do is they change all their ammunition handling procedures, they update the hatches, they reinforce things. By the time of the Battle of Jutland, 16 months later, Beattie has learned nothing, but the Germans have learned how to stop their ships blowing up. The Battle of Jutland, the British battle cruisers are hit in the turrets. They blow up, but the Germans don't. At Jutland, 9 German battle cruisers, turrets are penetrated by British shells. Ships lost, 0.
Wow.
Whereas the British, who hadn't learned the lesson, 4 British battle cruisers, turrets penetrated by shells, ships lost 3 of over 1,000 men apiece. Beattie at Dogger Bank, although he didn't know it, had thrown away 2 victories and both in a single morning. Not to mention the lives of over 3,000 men, and all because instead of practicing his gunnery, he would rather play tennis.
So, let me tell you about Admiral James Tiberius Kirk. Captain Kirk goes on to become an admiral in the latter stages of the Star Trek world. He's an admiral by the time of the Star Trek the motion picture, the first movie. And so that is a tenuous enough link for me to tell you that he was born in Riverside, Iowa, or rather will be, on March 22nd, 2233. And... in 1985, Riverside, Iowa petitioned Gene Roddenberry and Paramount Pictures for permission to adopt James Kirk as their town's future son. They approved the proposal. Paramount wanted $40,000 for a license to make a bust of Kirk, but the city instead just put a plaque with a little replica Enterprise named the USS Riverside. And they have a little like plaque saying future birthplace of James Tiberius Kirk in the town.
How very enterprising.
Yeah, very. Yeah. And they hold an annual Trek Fest in anticipation of his birthday. Coincidentally, last weekend, the city of Bloomington, Indiana also honoured one of its own in advance, because Bloomington, Indiana is the future birthplace of the captain of the Voyager, Captain Janeway, Captain Catherine Janeway. She'll be born there in 2336. And so some Star Trek fans unveiled a statue of Janeway last weekend along the Beeline Trail in Bloomington. Kate Mulgrew joined them via FaceTime or Zoom or something, and said that she would make the trip to see the statue in person once the pandemic is over. And I read, do you know that Captain Kirk has a crater named after him on the moon of Pluto, Charon?
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I must admit, I'm not a Trekkie in any way, shape or form.
No, nor am I, but it's nice to know you can just be in, you know, you can be in a TV show, and then suddenly you're immortalised on a distant planet.
Yeah. Kirk's crater feels like a euphemism for some horrible kind of venereal disease. Yeah. Have you heard about Barry? Yeah, oh, he's got Kirk's crater.
In the original pilot for Star Trek, by the way, the captain was called Captain Christopher Pike. There was a rejected pilot called The Cage. And then they developed a new episode called Where No Man Has Gone Before, and they changed the name to James Kirk because it was sort of inspired by Captain Cook.
Right. But in the reboots, in the J.J. Abrams reboots, Bruce Greenwood, who's a brilliant actor, plays Christopher Pike in the first one. And I'm trying to describe his look. He's got like that incredible sort of chiseled, wholesome matinee idol look down to a T. I would follow his Captain Pike into heavy gunfire.
That is the follow-up to Dad's Army that I want to see, though, Easy. Captain Pike.
Oh yeah.
I read a little bit more about Nelson because he's sort of the iconic admiral we all think of, largely thanks to being on top of a massive pillar in the middle of London. In his early naval career, he was served as a midshipman in the Carcass, a bomb vessel under Captain Skeffington Lutwidge, along with the Racehorse. It was part of Commodore Phipps's polar expedition, where they were always trying to find the northeastern passage to the Pacific, and he was on one of these. On one occasion, they had sort of docked somewhere, and Nelson and one of his shipmates, they went stalking a polar bear over the ice. And having been surprised by the animal, Nelson's weapon misfired, forcing him to fend off the bear with the butt of his rifle until he was able to escape. And there's an iconic painting of the incident by a guy called Richard Westall. And apparently he was saved from harm because a rift in the ice separated him from the polar bear. And a cannon was fired from the ship nearby to try and scare the bear off. And Nelson later justified his actions to the captain, saying he wanted to kill the bear so he could take the skin home to his father.
I love the idea of Nelson there trying to fend off a polar bear with the butt of his rifle going, I've miscalculated.
Yeah. Yeah.
And probably at the same time saying, don't you know who I am?
And the bear going, not yet. Nelson was the middle of 11 children. His parents had 11 kids, and so he was going to get no inheritance at all. So that's why he joined the Navy at the age of 12. His uncle was also in the Navy, a guy called Morris Suckling, and he said, you know, he didn't think Nelson was up to much. He said, what has poor Horatio done, who is so weak that he should be sent to rough it out at sea? But let him come, and the first time we go into action, a cannonball may knock off his head and provide for him at once. And during the Battle of Copenhagen in 1801, this is one of these occasions where he didn't obey orders. He was ordered to retreat by Admiral Sir Hyde Parker through the signal flags. And Nelson apparently lifted his telescope to his blind eye and said, I have a right to be blind sometimes. I really do not see the signal. And then ordered his forces to keep attacking the Danish and Norwegian forces, and led to a famous, you know, victory. And he said afterwards he'd fought contrary to orders, but he was appointed commander-in-chief after the battle for, you know, going his own way.
I love that his approach to leading the Navy there was basically your nana doing selective hearing.
Yes, it's very much. He was seasick, Nelson. He suffered famously from seasick. He wrote to the Earl of Camden, who was the Secretary of State for War in 1804. Camden's nephew had given up a career in the Navy because of his seasickness, and Nelson said, I am ill every time it blows hard, and nothing but my enthusiastic love for my profession keeps me 1 hour at sea. Which is a bit like, I also suffer from seasickness, but then virtue signaling by saying, but I've never let it stop me being in the Navy.
Yeah.
But I'm going to talk about my world's worst admiral is going to be a much more recent admiral than that. It's Admiral Miklos Horthy, an admiral in the former Austro-Hungarian Navy. And then after the Treaty of Trianon, the peace treaty that related to Hungary at the end of World War One, he became regent of Hungary, which was itself actually a kingdom and landlocked. So Horthy was an admiral of a country without a navy and ruler of a kingdom without a king.
Brilliant. That's a real sort of ice cream sundae of titles you built up there.
It really, really is. Now, when it was Austria-Hungary, they had some, you know, link to the sea. And he had been in the Austro-Hungarian Navy in the lead up to World War One, and he was such a respected figure that by the time it came to, you know, divvying the continent up at the end of it, he was invited to become regent of the kingdom by the Hungarian parliament. And he led Hungary right up through to World War Two. But Horthy's foreign policy basically was, I'm more scared of the commies than I am of the Nazis, and led him to ally himself quite closely to Hitler in the lead up to World War II. And Hungary was part of the Axis side, more in a sort of a supporting role than a frontline role throughout the Second World War, until it was eventually taken by the Germans in 1944. And Horthy you know, stepped down. But that then led to him basically supporting the Anti-Comintern Pact and withdrawing from the League of Nations and assisting Germany, shall we say, in the deportation of a lot of Hungarian Jews. And there is a letter that Horthy wrote to his prime minister where he said, "I have been an anti-Semite throughout my life." And it's one of those things where if when someone tells you who they are, you should believe them. But there are people who will argue that if Horthy hadn't, you know, given 100,000 Jews to Germany, then the Germans would have come and taken all of the Jews. It's very trolley problem-y, the whole sort of dialogue around Horthy, it seems. And he's a very controversial figure in Hungary to this day. Seems to be trying to protect his country from worse atrocities, but in doing so, helped a lot of terrible things to happen. But I particularly want to tell you about the history of the Hungarian Navy to help back this up.
Great.
Hungary did have an exit to the Adriatic for about 800 years. From 1102, Croatia and Hungary sort of entered into a union of sorts. You can get from Hungary to the Adriatic through Croatia until the end of World War I, when Croatia joins Yugoslavia. And so you no longer have a route. But having had that route to the sea, Hungary never really had much of a naval tradition. There was a Hungarian navy in the second half of the 1300s when they were, you know, competing against the Republic of Venice to try and own Dalmatia. But it was basically a Dalmatian navy with no Hungarians in it.
I presume it had 101 ships.
Yeah, and they were all white with black spots.
Great.
But after that, you're looking at a real gap up to the 1800s. The 27th of January, 1846, there's a journalist called Lajos Kossuth who wrote an article in a Hungarian publication called "To the Sea, Hungarians, Away to the Sea." And he wasn't saying, "Oh, we should suddenly have a massive navy." What he basically wanted was they wanted to build a railway line from the port of Fiume in Croatia and help develop merchant shipping and commerce, so they'd be able to export goods down the railway line to this harbour and then, you know, trade over the sea. A couple of years later, there's the split between Austria and Hungary and the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The new Hungarian government realises that they don't have a navy to guard the port and to keep this Adriatic shipping going. They're not part of Austria anymore, so they have to fend for themselves a little bit. And this guy Kossuth, the guy who wrote this To the Sea article, is now the finance minister. And so he says, we need to buy some ships. We need to set up a Hungarian navy. So begins the story of the Implacabile, the first and only Hungarian warship. First of all, it's not really a Hungarian ship. They go looking to buy a ship, and they find an Italian ship, the Implacabile, sold by a guy from Trieste, a guy called Spiridion Gopcevic.
Please tell me he's a second-hand military hardware salesman.
He's a merchant. He's got a few ships for sale that were merchant ships that he's like, if you want to buy them, I'll jazz them up, put a few guns on them, make them warships for you. He is selling both the Austrians and the Hungarians at the same time, even though they're about to go to war with each other.
Monty Python, put a beak on it, make good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're negotiating this sale. And the war minister, the Hungarian war minister, appoints an Italian-born guy, Vincenzo Domini, as the first captain of the first ship in the first Hungarian navy. He's a retired Austrian navy lieutenant. He's awarded the rank of captain in the Hungarian army because the navy still doesn't technically exist. But then war breaks out. And with Austrian support, the Croatians seize Fiume. This is this port where the Hungarians want to build their port and their railway line to and start their mercantile efforts from. And so it becomes even more important that they take back Fiume. Even though they've lost the one harbour, the Hungarians think we should still buy that ship because we're going to need it to take back Fiume. And so they come up with a plan where they're going to send the Implacabile to a neutral harbour. It'll be tarted up with all the guns and stuff, fitted out, and Domini will go there, take command of it, and sail it to Fiume and relieve it and take it back for Hungary. And so they send the ship to London. Domini intends to go on the ship. The ship has already left by the time he reaches it. So he then has to go by land to try to catch up with the ship. Eventually gets to London and he discovers that no efforts have been made to modify the ship. It hasn't been armed whatsoever. The guy who's captaining it on behalf of Gopcevic, the merchant, is a guy called Captain Jerkovic. He says he's received no orders to perform any modifications whatsoever. Not only that, he wants compensation for some of the damage the ship has suffered on the way to London. Oh, and by the way, because the English don't recognise the Hungarian government at this point, they won't give permission to Domini to actually fit out a warship in London anyway. So at this point, he's got a merchant ship without any guns in it, in a port where they won't let him put guns in it, with a captain who's saying, I haven't been told to put guns in it, and also, I want money for the fact that we've got a bit of rust on it when we were sailing it here.
He's feeling very much like Lord Nelson going against a polar bear right now, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah, and it gets worse. The war with Austria and Hungary is deepening. Gopcevich, the merchant, decides he wants even more money. So he keeps the brig in London while trying to extort even more money from the Hungarians. Captain Jurkovich is there saying he wants some money as well, or else I'm going to sail it back to Trieste, which Austria owns, and give it to the Austrians instead. Domini hears that the Austrians are basically going to win the war, loses his nerve, and turns himself over to the Austrian embassy instead. So instead of sticking with the Hungarians, he goes, I think the Austrians are going to win this. I'm going to tell them I have a ship for them in London with me. So he shows up at the Austrian embassy in London and says, here are the ship's papers for the ship, which I was meant to, you know, make a Hungarian ship. I'm now an Austrian again. I've always been loyal to Austria. Always said it. Very loyal. It's just impounded. Austria claims possession of it. The Hungarian government, they're not recognised by anyone. They have no recourse to law. Domini eventually goes back to Austria. He's arrested again, says he's loyal, and is eventually released. Never gave back the money that he had, that the Hungarians had given him to pay the ship's captain. He just kept that for himself. And eventually, they all just write it off as a terrible loss. No one's quite sure what happens to the Implacable. It may have gone back to Fiume, or it may have become an English cargo ship carrying wool. But I feel like that in a nutshell underlines what a terrible thing it is to be a Hungarian admiral. And not only that, a Hungarian admiral in the time after they'd lost any access to the sea, when you're also collaborating with the Nazis. I'm going to put forward Miklos Horthy as the world's worst admiral, an admiral of a country without any navy. So, our candidates this week for the world's worst admiral are Ben's suggestion of William Aethling, the son of Henry I, the man who should have been pulled over for drunk sailing and who plunged Britain into two-decade-long anarchy. Eric's suggestion of David Earl Beattie, the self-aggrandizing, self-promoting, self-interested commander of not one, not two, but three farcical naval maneuvers during World War I. And my suggestion of Miklos Horthy, the admiral of a country without a navy and ruler of a kingdom without a king. A nice sort of range. We've got the drunken incompetent, we've got the self-interested one, and we've got the one who is a victim of his own circumstances. I'm going to put Horthy to one side, because he seems a bit Route 1. And he may have been quite a good admiral if he'd been given a chance to, you know, command a few more ships.
He showed potential.
Yeah, he really did. You know, who hasn't collaborated with the Nazis if you're ruling a small middle European country in the 30s? And much as always, I'm tempted by William Aethling for his drunk sailing and the fact that it had mass, it was like the pebble dropped in the lake with the sort of the ripples spreading out and out and out. I think by sheer force of research alone, and that he also symbolises that it's that very sort of World War One thing of aristocratic commander who thinks he knows best and will blame everyone else but himself and who wouldn't learn from his mistakes. I am going to pick David Beattie as the world's worst admiral. So congratulations, Eric.
David Beattie does have a vibe of, no, you don't understand. I went to school with Triton and Poseidon. They're on my side. Good lads. Yeah.
Before we go, I've got to give you some of the world's best news of the week. And this comes from the UK. A mum in the UK, she's trying to get her daughter to ditch her soother, her dummy, her pacifier. And she encouraged her to do so by sending it away to the Dodo Ferry, as they called it. So she knew it was going to a special place for safekeeping. She invented the idea that there's a ferry you would send your soother to and they'll look after it for you once you give it up. So they packaged it up and addressed the parcel to the ferries and added their own address in case it needed to be returned to sender. And a few days later, a card came through the letterbox. It was accompanied by a letter to whom it may concern. My name is Les Haffenden, and I'm the late shift manager at Royal Mail, Home County's North Mail Centre. We got your parcel for the dummy ferry, and where we can, we try and reply to customers that have an address on the parcel. I have enclosed a thank you letter from the dummy ferries to show to your child to say thank you for sending the dummies to them. I hope this is okay. And the letter included with it a little card with some flowers and a fairy on it saying, thank you, you are so kind and courageous to give your dummy to the ferries. We are proud of you. And we promise to look after it.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah. So well done the people at Royal Mail for going above and beyond. Eric, before we go, where can people find out more about you or come and hear you or see you or anything like that, if indeed they can?
Oh, well, not in the moment. We're all in lockdown, aren't we?
Yeah.
I do have a Facebook page. Mm-hmm. It's Eric's Tales of the Sea, all one word. If you put that into Facebook, you'll find a page which every now and again I write something on, very seldom, mostly stuff about submarines, very, very seldom something about me, and I use it to spy on all my friends.
Nice. Excellent. So if you want to risk your GDPR protections there, go and visit Eric's website. Meanwhile, we're all off to go to sea, hopefully. We won't end up having to tap Ben if we get a bit thirsty. Thanks for listening to Worst Foot Forward. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Cheerio.
Worst Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.